This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 29th, 2007. From Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Ada Bogado. Hundreds of thousands descend on the nation's capital, demanding Congress end the Iraq War and reconsider impeachment. The U.S. State Department says Israel's use of American-made cluster bombs against Lebanon may be a violation of the Geneva Conventions. And a juvenile court judge issues a ruling in the Long Beach, California hate crimes case.
As I was walking out the court, they was just hollering me, Mama, Mama, just hollering and crying. I couldn't do nothing.
These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Shiite Iraqis are currently celebrating their holiest month of the year, but it has been marred by some of the worst violence since 2003. Hiba Dawood reports.
Up to 300 people died in fighting north of Najaf yesterday between an Iraqi-American force and Shiite insurgents calling themselves the Soldiers of Heaven. The insurgents' leader reportedly died in the clashes. Ali al-Fadl, a Shiite resident from Najaf, is relieved that the government has sent in forces to secure the city.
I feel that the Providence has protected us. They were a group of radicals in alliances with Al-Qaeda, and I'm very optimistic now.
Tomorrow, thousands of Iraqi Shiites will march to the Imam Hussein Shrine in the city of Karbala to commemorate one of the holiest days in the month of Ashura. Meanwhile, 9 people were killed in Baghdad today, including the Minister of Industry advisor and his daughter, driver, and the bodyguard. Yesterday, 5 secondary school girls were killed and 15 wounded in northern Baghdad when mortar shells landed in their schoolyard. In other news, Bahal Araghchi, member of the parliament and well-known figure in the Sadr movement, announced yesterday that an agreement had been reached to provide security in Shia-Sunni mixed neighborhoods. For FSRN, I'm Hiba Dawood reporting.
A suicide bomber killed 3 people and himself today in a bakery in the southern Israeli city of Eilat. Today's suicide bombing was the first to strike inside of Israel in 9 months. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade and Islamic Jihad have claimed joint responsibility for the blast. Rampant contract fraud in the war zones has prompted the Pentagon to launch some 50 criminal probes. Yan Mieshia has the story in Washington, D.C.
The Government Accountability Office reported recently that battlefield contract abuse under the Bush administration has cost taxpayers millions of dollars. Fraud allegations implicate senior contractors, government officials, and military personnel. Charles Cray is director of the Center for Corporate Policy.
You'll see an extraordinary number of private military companies or private security contractors performing jobs that formerly had been performed by enlisted personnel.
Now the U.S. Army Criminal Investigation Command is looking into allegations of contracting fraud. But Cray says the Pentagon has been slow to act.
I think that this is kind of a cynical attempt to assure the Congress that they are taking action at this late date so that the Congress doesn't have to.
The new Democratic Congress plans to ramp up oversights of spending in Iraq. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
The African Union today picked Ghana to lead the regional bloc for the next year. Sudan has been vying to head up the African Union, but was passed up for the position for the second year in a row due to the deteriorating situation in the country's western Darfur region. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon held a meeting with the Sudanese president today in an effort to get concrete answers about when the UN can join the AU's peacekeeping operation in Darfur. Sudan has repeatedly dodged commitments on allowing the UN to have an active peacekeeping presence on the ground in Darfur, and today was no exception. A landmark vote at the Sinn Féin National Conference in Dublin yesterday will move the Northern Ireland peace process forward. Maeve Conran reports.
An overwhelming majority of delegates at the conference voted to support a reformed police force in Northern Ireland. The decision is significant as the police service of Northern Ireland has long been regarded by Sinn Féin and Republicans as an armed force in collusion with the British Army and an institution of British rule. The fact that the police service has also been predominantly Protestant has further alienated the Catholic nationalist community. Yesterday's vote means that Sinn Féin will now support a police force that will move from being Protestant-dominated to a body that will proportionally represent the Catholic and Protestant population. agreement on the issue of policing by Republicans who are seeking a united Ireland and unionists who want to retain links to Britain is a vital step towards the establishment of a provincial government where both sides would share power. The St Andrews Agreement, reached in October 2006, calls for the establishment of a power-sharing government by March 2007 if all issues such as policing are resolved. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Maeve Conran.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Israel's use of cluster bombs in its war against Lebanon may have been illegal, according to the Bush administration. Human rights groups in the United Nations have been reporting that for months, but the announcement is significant because it's coming from the United States, a key ally of Israel. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The State Department isn't making the report public, but its preliminary findings suggest that Israel illegally used American-made cluster bombs in their war with Lebanon this past summer. One cluster ammunition, in the form of rockets or bombs, can contain anywhere from 50 to 1,000 explosives. A long-standing agreement between the U.S. and Israel prohibits their use in civilian areas. The United Nations Mine Action Agency have found 840 spots where they have been detonated. This assessment provided by the State Department is a result of the U.S.'s concern of the cluster bombs expressed during the war. Toward the end of the conflict, Israel requested more than 1,000 cluster bombs from the U.S., which totals more than 800,000 explosives. But the U.S. reportedly halted the transfer of the weapons because of Israel's alleged misuse of them. Mark Garlosek is a senior military analyst at Human Rights Watch.
This is the worst I've ever seen in my entire career. Just to give you a comparison, the United States dropped 2 million submunitions during 3 weeks in Iraq in 2003, and Israel dropped 4 million submunitions during 3 days in the 2006 conflict in Lebanon. And so we see a doubling of the number of submunitions used and a much shorter time frame.
Submunitions is the technical term for the cluster of explosives within one bomb. The United Nations reports that a high percentage of submunitions did not detonate upon contact, leaving about 1 million remaining in the area the size of Delaware.
If you pick them up or if you touch them or if you try to move them, they can blow up, and that's what's happening. You know, kids will look at these things and they'll say, oh, what is this interesting looking thing? Let me pick it up. It's often yellow, or sometimes it has a little parachute on the end of it. And so it's sometimes mistaken for a toy. And, you know, kids are kids. They like to play with these things. And so that's what's happening.
The United Nations Mine Action Agency says 180 people have died from unexploded cluster bombs since the war ended. The State Department assessment is a first step and will likely be expanded upon. This report is significant because of the U.S.'s rare criticism of Israel. Mark Garlosek with Human Rights Watch says it is odd the Bush administration
would be investigating such a close ally in the war on terror. I mean, obviously, the use of these weapons was so very egregious that the U.S. government was forced to take action.
The report was sent to Congress. Congress or the White House can decide to act. If any repercussions are imposed, it will likely be in the form of sanctions. Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat of California, introduced legislation last year. It would have halted all transfers of cluster bombs to Israel. It didn't go anywhere. U.S.-imposed sanctions would largely be symbolic. As the U.S. is Israel's biggest ally, the move would be recognized around the world. But sanctions would not interfere with the supply of Israel's cluster bombs. Although the U.S. has one of the largest stockpiles, registering at 1 billion according to Human Rights Watch, Israel has their own, as do 34 other countries who are eager to sell them. No international treaty exists, although momentum for one is growing. Rights groups have spearheaded discussions that have been considered between nations, but Russia, China, and the U.S. have opposed any international compact. Israel is conducting their own investigation on the cluster bombs. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Following 2 weeks of strikes in Guinea, which paralyzed all sectors of the economy and saw 60 demonstrators shot dead by security forces, the Guinean president has appointed a consensus prime minister and agreed to lower fuel and rice prices. The trade unions that led the strike expect the appointee to be a civilian. From neighboring Senegal, Njaga Sek reports.
Guinean President Lassana Conte has agreed to appoint a prime minister as head of the government following a general strike lasting 17 days. Security forces in the West African country shot dead some 60 people as tens of thousands of demonstrators marched to demand the resignation of the president. Trade union leaders have now called off the strike, but still aim at democratic advancement. Ibrahima Fofana is the Secretary General of the National Confederation of Guinean Workers, CNTG.
We've gone to the palace to talk to the president. They wanted us to discuss the living conditions of populations, the prices of rice and fuel. But we said those questions were not essential, because if we set to those prices and we don't have a government capable of enforcing them, there's no use. The present government has shown its incapacity to fulfill Guineans' needs, and people have stood up to express themselves clearly for a change in our country, and the call must be heard.
President Conte is a former army colonel who seized the power in a coup in 1984. In April 2006, he sacked the prime minister and has since then combined the post of president of the republic and head of government. The trade unions called on him to hand over all his powers to a new prime minister and retire. The two-week-long strike is the largest show of defiance in the president's 23-year reign. There were clashes and deaths in the capital Conakry, as well as other major towns across the country. Many trade union leaders were arrested, and the union headquarters sacked by an army unit, reportedly led by President Conte's son. Mariama Penda Diallo of the Guinean Workers' Union, USTG, was among those arrested.
During the arrest, I had rather slight injuries compared to the other injured or those who had been killed, so I don't complain. They took me to the police station and after the interrogation threw me in a cell. I was the only woman among 10 other people. There are also two boys, aged 16 and 12. The most aggressive security guard came in and told the chief of the cell that it didn't matter if you were a man or a woman, that he was the chief, so he could do all that he wanted. So he voluntarily asked those young people to attack me. But I commend the fact that the youth showed me respect. They made room for me, and they didn't touch me. They didn't attack me.
Guinea has rich reserves of bauxite, iron, and gold, yet the Guinean people are among the poorest on the continent. The country was the first French colony to gain its independence in 1958, but then experienced 26 years of authoritarian rule under its first president, Ahmed Sékou Touré. Life under the regime of Lassana Conte has been no easier. The strike aimed at toppling him was prompted in large part by soaring inflation over the past 3 years, which has made basic goods unaffordable for most Guineans. The cost of a 50-kilogram bag of rice had risen to 126,000 Guinean francs, about $22. This in a country where the average income per capita is about $2,000, according to UN figures, and the majority of people earn less than $1 a day. Union leader Ibrahim Fofana hopes that people who were killed in the strike have not died for nothing.
We present our condolences to the families, but obviously these people didn't die for nothing. They died for our country. May their souls rest in peace and allow us to reach the change all Guineans are waiting for.
On Friday, West African heads of state at a general ECOWAS meeting proposed sending delegation to Conakry to meet President Conte. For FSI and in Senegal, I'm Jagasek.
A superior court judge in Long Beach, California, ruled Friday that 8 African-American teenagers committed a hate crime last year when using racial insults while physically assaulting 3 young white women. 10 youth have been held in custody since the attack Halloween night in an upper-scale area of the city. 2 others are awaiting court hearings. Tandi Sizwe Shimaringa has the story.
In a case that has been rife with controversy from the beginning, including alleged witness intimidation, conflicting testimony, and lack of credible eyewitness identification, Judge Gibson Lee found that the petitions or charges against the 8 youths were true and threw out the petition against the youngest defendant, a 12-year-old. He also ruled that 1 other youth committed felony assault but not a hate crime. Defense attorneys and family members concede that the youths were in the wrong place at the wrong time, but that they are innocent of committing a hate crime.
I am stunned, shocked, flabbergasted, blown away.
Frank Williams is an attorney for a 17-year-old in the case.
I was believing that the evidence did not demonstrate that my client could possibly have the petition sustained, so I'm going somewhere to sulk and do what I do when I'm angry. So I'm very disheartened by it.
Attorneys for the youths say that they will appeal the decision. Much of their contention with the prosecution's case centers on lack of credible eyewitness identification of the youths, 911 tapes played during the trial that described the attackers as male, and the manner in which Long Beach police conducted the identifications of the youths. Police officers told the victims that they had apprehended the attackers, but did not provide a lineup for the victims that included non-suspects. During the trial, victims testified that they were able to identify their attackers by clothing, jewelry, and hairstyle.
My 17-year-old client, I've been assuring her every day, just let it take its place, you're going to be okay. And now it's very difficult for me to face her because I've asked her to trust in the system. And in my opinion, the system has let her down because there was no evidence, in my opinion, to demonstrate that she was guilty of anything. So I've got that difficult task because she's disheartened. She was literally incoherent with grief.
City officials requested a beefed-up law enforcement presence in anticipation of the verdicts, with police officers lining the courtroom, the courthouse hallway, and the streets. Two police helicopters circled the courthouse from above as approximately 300 people assembled in front. As the crowd learned of the verdict, it became clear that shock and sadness, not anger, were the dominant emotions. Sherelle Hardison has four children in custody. Her youngest child, the 12-year-old, was acquitted.
I know one thing is heart is heavy because you're hearing your kids just crying out to you, mama, screaming out, just looking at your kids and you can't do anything. It hurts. It hurts to know that your kids didn't do anything and they still in there. They won't even let them come home to even go to school. I have seniors in there. They want to go to their prom. They want to go to their graduation. Their grades are good. I don't see why that they can't come home. They need to come home.
Court will resume on Wednesday of this week when Judge Lee will hear victim impact statements. Sentencing for the youths should happen in another month's time after recommendations from the county probation department. Activists and family members say the case is not over. In the meantime, they are grappling with the reality of the verdict.
As I was walking out the court, they was just hollering me, mama, mama, just hollering and crying. I couldn't do nothing. These are kids don't even do anything. They barely come outside. They got too much to do. I have them in sports. They go to school. They have their chores to do, get their clothes together, eat dinner, get back the next day and start all over again. And by them going out that day, that was a treat for them. But I can't believe it. We all hurt, but we are going to fight. We're going to fight for our kids.
In Los Angeles, this is Tandisizwe Shimaringa for Free Speech Radio News.
A jury has convicted an 84-year-old woman from Seattle and two other activists for attempting to block the entrance to the Bangor Trident nuclear submarine base last year. They face a possible 6-month jail sentence. Mark Taylor Canfield has more from Seattle.
I remember vividly when the atom bomb was dropped in Hiroshima Day of 1945.
Shirley Morrison is a member of the Raging Grannies, and one of the defendants, referred to by their supporters as the Ground Zero 3.
But I do not remember very much about anything about that atom bomb excepting that the war was over.
Years later, at the World's Fair in Seattle, she says she had a transformative experience that changed her opinion about nuclear weapons.
It was when the World's Fair was here. I spent quite a bit of time in the Japanese pavilion, and there was photographs from Hiroshima, and I was really appalled. I didn't have any real knowledge of, you know, that was what it was all about, but I was just beginning to be aware.
The Ground Zero Center for Nonviolence was established just outside the Bangor Naval Base in 1977 to provide training in nonviolent civil disobedience for anti-nuclear activists. Over 3 decades, 250 protesters have been arrested during demonstrations against the U.S. Navy's fleet of Trident submarines. Shirley Morrison, now 84, has taken part in many of the protests and has been arrested 8 times. Last year, she and her co-defendants were arrested for acts of civil disobedience at 2 separate demonstrations at the gates of the Bangor Naval Base. A jury at the Kitsap County Courthouse has now found them guilty on 2 counts of disorderly conduct. They could be sentenced to up to 6 months in jail and $2,000 each in fines. Despite the guilty verdicts, Brian Watson, Carol Ann Barrows, and Shirley Morrison consider the trial a victory for the anti-nuclear weapons movement because for the first time the judge allowed activists to call expert witnesses on international law and U.S. nuclear weapons policy in their defense. The attorney for the defendants argued that because international law states that those who fail to stop war crimes can be found complicit in those crimes, the Ground Zero 3 were acting in accordance with internationally recognized conventions. Brian Watson lives near the Bangor Naval Station.
Bangor has the largest concentration of nuclear weapons in the entire United States. Not only is Trident a violation of international law, law such as the Hague Conventions and Nuremberg Principles, it's also a violation of the very law that governs how military campaigns are waged. Army field manuals, for instance, say that you can't use methods of warfare that fail to distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. No matter which way you look at it, they're illegal just as the gas chambers were illegal.
John Burroughs, executive director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, was an expert witness for the defense at the trial of the Ground Zero 3.
There are still about 27,000 nuclear warheads in the world. The United States and Russia, between the two of them, have about 20,000 plus of those warheads. The doctrines about use have gotten more aggressive over the last few years. The Bush administration has said that nuclear weapons might be used in response to surprising military developments. And that's one of the troubling things about the buildup of the Trident submarines here at Bangor, Washington.
Ground Zero activists say they're undeterred by the current court cases. This year, on Martin Luther King Day, 13 more protesters were arrested at the base by Kitsap County Sheriff's deputies and Navy security officers. In spite of her conviction and a possible jail sentence, Carol Ann Barrows of Code Pink is determined to continue her work for the abolition of nuclear weapons.
I hope that more people become aware of the nuclear weapons of Puget Sound and the power of international law and citizens' responsibility to abolish nuclear weapons. And I want, instead of 3 people going to trial, I want 100 people going to trial. I want 1,000 people going to trial. I want 10,000 people going to trial. Clog up the jails, clog up the courts, and stop this. We have the power.
This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
Code Pink Women for Peace shut down part of the Rayburn and Hart Senate buildings today as some 800 anti-war activists from 47 states were meeting with U.S. lawmakers. The meetings were held to urge Congress to end the Iraq War, prevent an expansion of the Iraq War into Iran, and hold the Bush administration accountable for the claims it made in launching the Iraq War. As Reem Katuda from the D.C. Radio Co-op reports, this came after hundreds of thousands of people marched in D.C. this weekend, calling on Congress to stop funding the war, bring the troops home, and reconsider impeachment.
One group shut down the building in the House, and then we took over the building in the Senate.
Medea Benjamin, the co-founder of Code Pink.
And all of a sudden, there was a pink banner that came out and it said, troops home now. All of a sudden, there were 6 more banners that were on the top, on the bottom, in the middle.
The Code Pink Women for Peace dropping some 15 anti-war pink banners and a pink slip for all those who dare to still support the war came from as far as Washington State, Oklahoma, Florida, and joined the rallies and the actions this weekend for peace.
Silence is no longer an option.
Green goes our Iraq.
Jane Fonda and other celebrities and officials on stage and a determined crowd marching on Capitol in Washington, D.C., rallied with clear message to the U.S. administration.
Congress must defund the war!
Congress must defund the war!
And bring our troops back to our shores!
They say there were 500,000. They surrounded the Capitol for the first time in history and put impeachment back on the table. Some 11 contingents walked through the neighborhoods in D.C. before joining the anti-war rally, talking about affordable housing, global warming, labor struggles, education, and amplifying a peace message barely mentioned by United for Peace and Justice rally organizers. Other actions included a day-long teach-in in Bethesda, lobbying all day today and tomorrow, and sit-ins blocking Independence Avenue in a big peace sign on the Capitol and in front of the White House all night long, pledging to come back and stay till peace is won.
Rallies seem to, they start and then they finish. Sit-in demands attention. It demands an answer. It's a little civil disobedience. Goes a long way.
I'm Reem Katkhuda with help from the DC Radio Co-op .org.
Among the masses who attended the anti-war rally in March in Washington on Saturday were many for whom it was their first such national protest. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus interviewed some of them and filed this report.
People were of all ages, races, and national origins. André Colombin is a native of France who recently became a U.S. citizen.
Now that I'm a citizen, I feel obligated to say what I think.
And what do you think?
I think this war should not have started in the first place, that the people were misled by the leaders of this country. They were never given the full information, that information was used to convince people to support the war, and it's just getting worse and worse.
Referring to President Bush's recent decision to send more troops to Iraq, Colomba said,
"By doubling up on a bad decision is just making it worse, and what we need is a radical new, a very different kind of approach, and what we see is just more of the same."
Shirley Rodriguez came from Boston.
I just want the troops to come home because I have my best friend, he's in the army, and one of my other good friends, and they're not able to come home, and they have families here, and they're over there fighting. I'm just here just to demonstrate, you know, I have their backs.
Jay Moore came from Montana with his wife and daughter. He said the timing for this demonstration was critical.
We have Congress just kind of getting up to steam now. It's a new Congress. We thought we told them what we wanted. Apparently they haven't learned or listened. And this is one way of, you know, shouting loud.
His daughter, Wendy Morgan of Los Angeles, said she couldn't stay away.
As soon as he announced that we were deploying more troops, it was something I had to do. Even though I was not feeling well and really shouldn't be here physically, I had to be here because it's the least I can do for our troops and for our country.
Reporting from Washington, D.C., I'm Melinda Tuhus for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to FSRN, an independent, listener-supported newscast produced by Tina Gousset and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety at www.fsrn.org. We welcome your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. In Richmond, Virginia, I'm Catherine Kump, sitting in for Otto Bogato.